is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I am Chinedu Ofor, and here's what's coming up.
There is a pattern that is emerging from the way the state is conducting itself, particularly pertaining to the journalists. There is an attempt to clamp down on the media, to cow down free reporting, so that only the version of the state is out there.
That was Zimbabwe sociopolitical analyst Effie Ngube on the arrest of 10 journalists last week while covering a public meeting of the Election Commission. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. The chairman of Libya's High National Electoral Commission, Ahmad El Sayer, confirmed that Prime Minister Abdel Hamid Dbeibah and Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, the son of Muammar Gaddafi, have the right to run in the upcoming presidential elections. The Libya Stats website conducted a week-long opinion poll on which candidates was most likely to win the election. Results showed that Gaddafi was the most popular candidate with 48% of the votes, followed by General Khalifa Haftar with 30% and Prime Minister Dbeibah with 17%. Wolfgang Putzai, former Australian military attaché in Libya, discusses these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy.
The powers of the head of state are clearly defined in Article 15 of the so-called Election of the President of the Libyan State Law, the electoral law adopted by the House of Representatives. According to this law, to this Article 15, the powers of the president will be balanced by the House of Representatives, which cannot be dissolved by the president. And even in the case of a national emergency, the president needs the approval of the National Security Council, which includes also members of the House of Representatives, and the decision must be presented to the HOR within 10 days for approval. But of course, as the president is directly elected by the Libyans, his position will be at least informally much stronger than that of current Presidential Council Chair Al-Menfi. But I would say this should help also to break the current political stalemate in Libya.
The Libya State's website, which specializes in polls related to the country, conducted a week-long opinion poll on which candidate was most likely to win the presidential elections. The opinion poll, in which over 3,000 people participated, showed that Saif al-Islam al-Qaddafi was the most popular candidate with 48% of the votes. Haftar came in second place with 30% of the votes. Dbeibah received 17% of the votes, while only 4% voted for former Interior Minister Fathi Bashagha. What's your take on that?
I would say this is a very interesting opinion poll, but the survey is not representative. Nevertheless, it clearly shows the dissatisfaction of many who participated. There is certainly a relatively strong sentiment reflecting that the security situation, energy supply, and the daily living circumstances are perceived, and I would actually say they were really better during the Gaddafi era. And this is underlined through those voting in this poll for Saif. The difficult security situation in northern Tripolitania, which is worse than in fall last year, and the perceptions of neglect by the Tripoli-centric administration in the east and in the south certainly helps Khalifa Haftar. All this should be taken for serious by those who intend to run for Libya's presidency. And even more important, each of these problems should be a key element of the program of any future Libyan government.
Representatives of the upper house based in Tripoli in Libya's west held 2 days of talks in Morocco's capital, Rabat, with Libyan parliament, whose seat is in the eastern city of Tobruk, without any sign of agreement on the disputed electoral law. How could elections be held on time with no agreement on the electoral law?
The only legally entitled institution to pass over an electoral law to the HNEC, to the High National Election Commission, for implementation is Libya's legislative, the House of Representatives. According to the Libya Political Agreement from 2015, the High Council of State, the HCS, has just an advisory role, but no veto right. So I guess the HOR will adopt the law for parliamentary elections in the next week or at the latest in about 2 weeks. Thereafter, the HNEC will probably issue the election calendar based on this with all the deadlines up to the elections. It could well be that the HNEC will postpone the elections for a few weeks for technical reasons to ensure compliance with all the deadlines mentioned in these laws. But things are not that easy. A key problem will be if the High Council of State, if Islamist groups and others will demand from the population not to participate in the elections because they don't accept the law, if the voter turnout is as low as it was in 2014, which means less than 20% of those in the voting age, this would certainly undermine the credibility of the outcome. And this would be an extremely dangerous development for Libya. From my point of view, the three most important points in the run-up to the elections right now are to use all available means to motivate those who registered to vote to participate on election day, to organize an efficient observation of the elections by national and international observers, including by technical means, and to get a commitment of the main actors, including from the High Council of State, that they will accept the outcome of the elections if HNEC and the international observers confirm that the elections were conducted by and large in a regular way.
That was Wolfgang Putsai, former Australian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy. The recent leak of a vast document trove shows that the family of Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta has a secret fortune hidden in offshore assets. The International Consortium of Investigative Journalists obtained records detailing the hidden wealth of a number of current and former world leaders and their associates. The ICIJ has analyzed the data and shared the findings with more than 600 journalists and news organizations around the world. The ICIJ says the documents, called the Pandora Papers, show that Kenyatta and his mother, sisters and brother have shielded some of their wealth in offshore foundations and companies, and the assets are worth more than $30 million. Uhuru Kenyatta is the son of Kenya's first post-election president, Jomo Kenyatta. The Kenyattas have long been considered one of the wealthiest families in Africa, with holdings in farming, dairy production, real estate, and banking. Much of that wealth was accumulated long before Uhuru Kenyatta became president. The overseas funds, while not necessarily illegal, cast doubt on the sincerity of President Kenyatta's call for official transparency to fight corruption. Tensions have heightened between Algeria and France in response to comments by French President Emmanuel Macron, which Algeria is calling unacceptable. On Sunday, the Algerian government banned French military planes from its airspace, even though the spokesperson for the French armed forces said the closure would have no major consequences. Analysts say it will undoubtedly affect their operations in the region. To explain the spat between the two countries, International Edition's Jackson Vongani reached Catherine Field, a reporter and analyst based in Paris.
It is alleged by the Algerian authorities that during a meeting at the Elysee Palace last week that President Emmanuel Macron had with young French people, that he talked about Algeria. And it is alleged he made remarks saying that Algeria is ruled by a political military system, that they had totally rewritten their history. And allegedly, he said that Algerian history is based on a hatred of France. And he said the idea in Algeria is that France is the problem. Now, the Elysee Palace have not denied that the president made these remarks, have not confirmed that he made these remarks. But the idea that the French president would have, even within a small circle of invitees, the Elysee Palace, made these remarks about Algeria certainly would have caused some upset in Algiers.
So, Catherine, it was reported that France will sharply reduce the number of visas granted to people from Algeria, Morocco, and Tunisia. How serious is this, and how will it affect the residents of these four countries?
It is very serious in lots of ways because these are three countries which account for a large number of illegal immigrants in France. And the French authorities are saying, look, we have a lot of these people come to our courts, we issue expulsion orders, but we're unable to return them. And just as an example, the first 6 months of this year, French courts ordered the expulsion of 7,731 Algerians. Now, to expel them, you have to get the approval of the Algerian authorities. And the Algerians only agreed to take 22 of those. So the French are saying, we've tried, we are really trying. And in particular, we're trying very hard to get the most dangerous ones sent back. And none of these three governments are playing ball. They're just not doing their part. They say they had no choice but to bring in these new regulations to reduce the number of visas.
Right. And how did these countries react to this news that the visas would be reduced?
Well, all three of them initially said, look, this isn't true. We've been doing our part. The one that has really reacted the most strongly, of course, has been Algeria, that called in the French ambassador to Algiers, said that they were very unhappy with this, said that this was really out of order for the French to do this. And then in the last, I would say, 72 hours, really escalated it, and this new diplomatic crisis that we're into now.
When Macron was elected, is what, 4 or 5 years ago in 2017, it was suggested that he represented a new generation of French politicians and politics, especially in the foreign policy arena, his relationship with Africa, and, you know, the relationship with France's former colonies in the Maghreb. How has this relationship been panned out in the last 4 or 5 years?
There are very different relationships with different countries. And I take, for example, France's relationship with Rwanda. It really has been a relationship where the French have worked on their recognizing some of the excesses during the colonial period. And that's a very different relationship than France has with Algeria, particularly Algeria. We're coming up to the 60th anniversary of the end of the Algerian War of Independence. It's a very difficult relationship. And there hasn't been the full depth and breadth of the historical discussion about what went on in Algeria in the same way that it has done in parts of Africa. So when you look at Algeria and French relations, they are so scratchy, they are so raw still, that even the slightest word out of order or the slightest hint that there might be some sort of French, if you like, arrogance or supremacy towards Algeria, then the relationship can spin out of control very quickly.
France has been counting on support and cooperation from these Maghreb countries in regards to its operations in Mali. Does this rupture in relations amount to France shooting itself in the foot, so to say?
The French military aren't putting it like that. They say that it slightly impacts on their ability to be able to supply their troops who are stationed in northern Mali, but they say it will not affect operations. Clearly, the French did not think that the Algerian authorities were going to take this step, because they only found out about this ban on French military aircraft when they put forward their flight plan first thing on Sunday morning. And this has been the route that French Air Force planes have taken regularly since Operation Barkhane started, and even before that, during these operations in the Sahel. On top of that, let's not forget that France depends a lot on Algeria on that border area. The southern Algerian border is a huge border when you're talking about illegal migration, with uncontrolled migration. This is an area where the French really feel that they have to have some sort of dialogue with the Algerians.
That was Catherine Field, a reporter and analyst based in Paris, speaking with International Edition's Jackson Mvungani. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has been sworn in for a second five-year term as his country remains mired in a bitter war. Abiy's Prosperity Party was declared the winner of parliamentary elections earlier this year. The Prime Minister faces major challenges as war that began in November 2020 in the Tigray region spreads into other parts of the country. Tens of thousands of people have been killed in the fighting, hundreds of thousands have been displaced, and the United Nations warns hundreds of thousands of people face famine in the country's north. Rights organizations say all parties to the conflict have committed human rights abuses. Last week, the UN humanitarian chief told the Associated Press the crisis in Ethiopia is a, quote, stain on our conscience, unquote, as people starve under what the UN says is essentially a government blockade. A few days after that, Ethiopia expelled 7 senior UN staff from the country. The U.S. government says it wants to partner with African countries to combat climate change. The U.S. climate envoy is in South Africa to discuss the issue and prepare for a key conference next month. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
The U.S. Deputy Special Presidential Envoy for Climate Change, Jonathan Pershing, said the fight against climate change must be an international one.
These kinds of damages don't limit themselves to one country. You can't say, I've got a problem and nobody else does, but neither will any country be immune. You don't have to be a landlocked country or an island country or a coastal country. We are all in this together. And that brings me to why I have come to Africa. It's the fastest growing continent. It's a continent that in many ways represents the future. What it chooses to do could either leapfrog the past or follow the previous historical trajectory.
The State of the Climate in Africa 2019 report, a publication coordinated by the World Meteorological Organization, showed increasing climate change threats to people's health, food and water. The predictions on weather patterns covering the years between 2020 and 2024 call for a continued warming trend and less rainfall in northern and southern Africa. This has major consequences for the continent. Farmers in Africa depend on their natural environment to grow crops, and due to unpredictable weather patterns, they're getting less food from the farms. According to the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, the number of undernourished people in sub-Saharan Africa has increased by 45% since 2012. Pesching said despite the challenges, Africa's natural resources can transform the economic fortunes of many countries.
We could have the critical minerals that Africa has in abundance servicing that global demand. That is countries like Kenya, it's countries like Namibia. We have forest opportunities in countries like the Congo, both of the Congos in Brazzaville and Kinshasa, real windows of opportunity. We have extraordinary capacity around ports and fishing choices that could be all of our coastal nations. This is an opportunity that is continent-wide.
Pesching said climate issues matter to Americans and say the U.S. wants to work with Africa to solve the global problem. Developed countries have pledged some $100 billion per year to help developing countries mitigate climate change. In 2019, $80 billion was collected. Wanjira Maathai is a vice president and regional director for Africa at the World Resources Institute based in Nairobi. She says Africa needs to invest in its people and lands to mitigate climate change.
We have to invest in adaptation. We have to invest in cushioning and building resilience in our cities, in our rural settings, and certainly in investing in energy, because energy will ensure that we can make the necessary transitions that will cushion us. Now, building resilience, especially in the rural areas, will require protecting and restoring nature.
High-level officials are expected to gather in Glasgow next month for the COP26 Climate Summit to accelerate action towards the goal of the Paris Agreement. The 2016 agreement set out to limit global warming caused by climate change to 1.5 degrees. It also supports countries' efforts to deal with the impacts of climate change. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The Zimbabwe ruling party's crackdown on the opposition and media appears to be intensifying, with 10 journalists arrested last week while covering a public meeting by the Electoral Commission. Andy Gondo gives us more on the story.
Armed troops and police sealed off the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission ZEC headquarters and jammed streets in Harare, ostensibly to forestall a looming protest by the MDC Alliance over the commission's decision not to invite the main opposition party to talks on electoral reforms. Journalists covering the event were arrested, with three opposition party officials, sparking condemnation from media organizations and analysts. The Zimbabwe Union of Journalists, ZUJ, the Media Institute in Southern Africa, MISA, and the Voluntary Media Council of Zimbabwe, VMCZ, have slammed the arrest as another brazen attack on media freedom, despite government assurances on the issue. Two journalists were detained while covering another opposition event a few weeks ago. The media groups point out that the journalists were properly accredited and were covering a public meeting. Tabani Moyo of MISA says the arrest and release without charge of journalists reveals structural challenges.
The practice wherein the law enforcement agencies can actually scoop on journalists who are duly accredited doing their work as a form of an irony at the offices of the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission. The Zimbabwe Electoral Commission is supposed to be a Chapter 12 institution, which represents the wholesale gamut of democratic existence, because it is supposed to run democratic elections. If journalists can then be arrested at the offices of such an institution,
then where else can they be safe to perform their craft? This is a sobering question.
Moyo says the arrest plunges Zimbabwe further into a difficult spotlight given the track record of arresting and harassing journalists carrying out their duties. Lofty Dube of the Voluntary Media Council of Zimbabwe says accredited journalists should not have to be subjected to such treatment.
The arrest of the 10 journalists which occurred last week is a serious cause for concern for issues of media freedom. We have noted that the issue of the collective arrest of journalists when they're at public events by members of the police force has been recurring, and it's something we are worried about. This is a bearing in terms of the media freedom index, in terms of how Zimbabwe is viewed in terms of media violations, because how it impacts on the country perception.
Social political analyst Effie Ncube called the arrest an unconstitutional step in the wrong direction, which heralds a future of possible brutal suppression.
There is a pattern that is emerging from the way the state is conducting itself, particularly pertaining to the journalists. There is an attempt to clamp down on the media, to cow down free reporting, so that only the version of the state is out there. There is an attempt to cow down the media that is reporting on corruption, on human rights abuses, so that we are left with the media that the state controls. It is important that the generality of the people of Zimbabwe do realize that an attack on the media is an attack on them as a society, because their rights are never going to be safe when the right to freedom of the media is violated.
And other observers call it an orchestrated attempt to muzzle dissent that will inhibit the country's efforts to shed its current pariah state image. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
Coal provides more than 75% of South Africa's energy supply, but due to global warming, pressure is mounting for that to change. Protests were seen across the country last week, and now a proposed Chinese-backed coal power plant may be scrapped. Linda Giftash has this report from Johannesburg.
It's what keeps the lights on and industries running. But South Africa's coal energy sector is facing mounting pressure at home and abroad to end its use of coal for good. Frustrated with regular blackouts and the effects of pollution, citizens of the mineral-rich country rallied last week demanding cleaner, more reliable, and affordable alternatives. Eureka Pius was among the protesters from Soweto.
Electricity has always been a problem in our community. So our community members went forward and they fought for electricity. But when the electricity came, it came at a very high price. We know that solar power is a better solution and it will be cheaper.
South Africa is among the world's top 15 largest emitters of carbon dioxide. Its reliance on coal stems from having vast quantities of the resource underground. This week, though, South Africa's government told the United Nations it's setting up more ambitious climate targets. While environmentalists welcomed the commitment, they say the change to the energy sector is not happening fast enough. Nicole Losser is an attorney with the Center for Environmental Rights.
We have to drastically reduce our emissions and reduce our reliance on coal by about 80% within the next 10 years, less than 10 years. We aren't seeing those changes happening fast enough. We also know that we need to essentially double our renewable energy build-out plans. That also is not happening.
As the rest of the world races to tackle climate change, analysts say pressure from business and foreign governments can force a faster green transition in South Africa. Chris Yelland is an energy analyst with EE Business Intelligence.
If we do not reduce our overdependence on coal, we will be punished by our trading partners who will set up cross-border tariffs. And ultimately, South Africa relies on trade with the rest of the world.
China announced last week it would no longer fund foreign coal projects. That means a Chinese-backed coal project slated to power a new industrial complex in South Africa's northern province of Limpopo may not materialize. Analysts like Chris Yellen say China's decision will have long-term ramifications.
China was seen to be perhaps the last outpost of finance that could be available for new coal, and there's nobody else to pick up this ball to finance this new coal-fired power. So I think the days of new coal in South Africa are over.
The prospect of cancelling coal is a major victory for protesters who want to see South Africa embrace renewables on a larger scale. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I am Gina Rocco in Washington. For all latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. And thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.